All right, everyone. This is the beginning of season 3, episode 2 of the Shadow Dragon podcast. We've got Joe Stratinger here, CEO and founder of Edge Theory. And we got the usual suspects, Daniel Clemens, CEO and founder of Shadow Dragon, and Shadow Dragon's own CTO, Elliot Anderson. So we wanted to talk about last week. Daniel and I went down to Ole Miss, University of Mississippi, for the summit for the National Center for Narrative Intelligence. We want to talk about that. We'll get to it here shortly. But first, Joe, tell us about yourself, how you came to have Edge Theory. I want to know it all from the time that you were a CPA to now.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm a recovering CPA. That is my background. And I started my career way back in Dallas when there was not the internet. I started my career and just got in the right place at the right time. Ended up moving in 1991 over to Budapest and did a lot of privatization, which was a really exciting time. I was 22, green bean, but I learned how to value companies in a communist regime and how do you sell that to the West, you know, and privatize. And so it was very interesting, but I came back and then long story through a friend of mine who wanted to sell his business. I met a guy named Mark Cuban who wanted to buy my friend's business. And that led to an interesting relationship. And then 5 years later, how I got into what we do today, my friend was going to leave. Mark back then was, you know, there was no YouTube. He was perfecting streaming online, and it had never been done before. And so my friend ended up leaving before Mark sold to Yahoo Broadcast. And we built the first company to sell CDs online. And so people laughed at us. And but back then, Amazon was only selling books. They did not have inventory. They did not have warehouses. They used a company in California called Valley Media to pick, pack, ship books and send them to your house. Mm-hmm. I literally copied that model and did it with CDs. And so I used the same company to, I built a company in Dallas, and we would pick pack, we would pay them to pick pack, ship CDs to your house. And it was the Wild West. We used e-commerce, of course. And that's back when, you know, people were trying to figure out where sales tax was going to be attributed and all that good stuff. So, but what happened was we were trying to figure out how do we, you know, sell these things and how do we get people to our website. There was no social media and so forth. And so we went into chat rooms and just one night in the middle of the night said, let's go to chat rooms. And again, back then, you know, my partner now, Jim Barksdale, was building Netscape at the time, which everybody thought the internet was just a place to browse. But we soon realized that actually there was people in these very interesting chat rooms that were very genre specific, you know, Joe Christian, Joe Country, Joe Hip Hop. And we would go into them in the middle of the night and say, hey, you want to buy Amy Grant, Travis Tripp, whatever. And we would send them to our link to our e-commerce. And we're like, oh, my gosh, this is a place you can have a conversation. You know, and that was a really mm-hmm. wild thought. And so that, you know, that obviously changed my world. But that's how I got into CPA, you know, narratives.
I remember, I think, was it like Columbia Clearinghouse or something?
Exactly.
Like 30 CDs for $30 or
so that
CD now,
the 30 yeah. CDs for $30. That was you?
No. I'm saying that was what, you know, the whole catalog was what, you know, preceded us. And then of course, you know, we were way before any kind of streaming, but we just back then Netflix was the DVD in the white envelope. Kind of thing. But yeah, we just realized that, hey, this is going to be this internet thing is going to be a place I thought that was going to go, oh my gosh, it's going to be an opportunity to go sell things. E-commerce was pretty the Wild West back then. You know, yeah. E-commerce was really new. And we just sort of, I think, blended this idea of e-commerce or selling things with the art of conversation, right? Which is listen, think, speak, analyze, right? And how do you do that and apply that to go sell things? You know, so that's sort of fast forward how we got to where we are today.
So, that's right. And so now you're doing some of the narrative intelligence stuff with your new company, Edge Theory. Can you tell us a little bit about that? And I've seen it, but Elliot hasn't seen it. It's very close to some of the stuff we do. Like we do tons of collection, but we don't do any correlation. We don't tell you kind of what some of it means or a larger picture. We're very artifact centric and you're kind of big picture centric. Tell us about that. I mean, it's super cool. Elliot, I really liked it. You know, I thought it was cool.
Well, thank you. Yeah. So Edge Theory, you know, we position ourselves as an AI powered narrative intelligence company. And, you know, narrative intelligence, you know, we're new. We obviously have been in the government space now in our fifth year, but we come from a commercial dual use background. Some of the day told me, you know, think of narrative intelligence or the conference. A lot of people were using the word narrant, like human or SIGINT. And some of the day told me that, someone in Washington said, oh no, you're like the new, you're the pickleball of ints. I thought that was interesting, right? The pickle, and so think of
narrant. Some people might not like that.
Yeah, exactly. But I do think, you know, narrative intelligence, we've been doing it forever, but we see it being a critical new sport within the OSINT Olympics, if you will. There's lots of great sports in OSINT that are very valuable to public and private enterprises. We see narrative intelligence being a very important new critical sport. Of course, Edge Theory wants to be the best team at that sport. But what narrative intelligence is simply how do you study how narratives start, spread, grow, and cause impact. And those narratives can cause healthcare outcomes. They can drive people to do stupid things. They can drive people to accept or not accept vaccines. They can win wars. They can win elections. They can tank stocks. You know, narratives are very, very powerful. And what that is, you know, we look at the world as sort of the cycle of narrative-based influence. And a lot of people still to the day worry, I think, too much about social media monitoring. And so when we look at the world, it's like, think of a trigger. A trigger is an event, October 7th, right? You know, things happen and that creates chatter. Chatter is very noisy, very loud. It's very hard to get any kind of signal over noise. But then chatter becomes narratives. And what we mean by that is blogs are written, podcasts are recorded, videos are recorded, and things become to take a little more shape. And then, of course, that drives impact. So a trigger is October 7th. There's a lot of chatter. Chatter creates people to write blogs and videos. And then, of course, that has impact and people change and it influences people on emotions and stuff like that. So narrative intelligence is, although we look at chatter, we study narratives. And different from chatter or social media monitoring, where you're, you know, hey, people are talking about Chinese spy balloons. Well, that's interesting. But what does that really tell you? We actually tell you who's talking about Chinese spy balloons. Where did it start? How did it grow? How did the narrative mutate? And what was the impact or the measure of effectiveness, if that makes sense? So it's a little different than social media monitoring.
That makes sense. I think if I were to just come at this from a skeptic perspective, right? We've all been to like 4chan and every other post is something wild, something crazy. But every now and then there's Jeffrey Epstein post that's, you know, a breaking news, that's your catalyst type event. What's the process you used of that understanding a starting point and then understanding sort of I'd say maybe the big players or sort of what's affecting what caused that a waterfall of information to come out and then create the narrative? I'd be curious to understand like what you guys' philosophy or technique is for maybe not technically, but just sort of, you know, philosophically slash, you know, tradecraft.
Yeah, we definitely, you know, I'll come back. We definitely don't opine, but how we're structured, we, you know, a couple of reasons we see how we're unique. First is our worldview and our approach. We do not look at the internet as this massive group of documents and information, which is what a lot of collectors do, right? How we go collect as much as we can. We look at the world.
Well, originally the internet was documents. So yeah, exactly, I think probably why. So,
exactly. And that's a great point. But we look at the world or the information environment, should I say, not as just a collection of documents. We look at the information environment as entities pursuing goals through documents. And when you take a worldview starting with the source, right, which a lot, which y'all do, and when you look at sources. So we're very, very, Elliot, source centric. And not only is that our worldview, that's our architecture. We don't start with search and then traverse down into the sources. We start with sources at the very fundamental level of the feed of anything and everything around a publicly available source. And so when you do that, you get signal over noise. So back to how we vet those or look at those sources, we have modules. Actually working early on, we first met our first kind of customer. We were in the room with a general and he's like, make this simple. I want to look at this as if it's a currency. And so we literally built one of our dashboards like a Bloomberg terminal, but instead of the currency being stocks and bonds, the currency is the narrative. Zelensky, you know, whatever, abortion, immigration. And we show the rising fall of narratives, how they come in and out and how they're spent. And then who's behind them. And so as relates to sources, if you think of a terminal like a Bloomberg terminal and you think of the currency as the narrative, we then have modules. And so modules are everything from US media, Middle East media, Sub-Saharan Africa media, Central South America media, the Duma, Parliament, US Congress, and on and on and on. And so we have modules of sources. And those, of course, by law, US Congress is US Congress, right? So we bring in the publicly available information. But when you think of other sources like form line influence, those are very much driven on the customer's request. So we do not, right. You know, if you think of US media, we bring in the right, we bring in the left. We do not opine. And if you want to understand the signal over noise on a certain topic within US media and who's behind that narrative, whether they're right, left, pink, purple, we're going to give you who's behind that. Does that help, Elliot?
Yeah, no, it absolutely does. And I think conceptually what you're talking about makes sense. I mean, we soak up data sources, right? Constantly, everywhere we go. You know, one of the things we do at Shadow Dragons, we focus on human behavior. And so what you guys are really doing is, you know, we track, people are on Strava, people are on, we just added a bunch of stuff that does car stuff because everybody, you know, well, a lot of people have cars, right? Sorry if there's wind. I'm literally sitting on a deck in Kalispell. I apologize for that. The concept of tracking that, focusing on the source is definitely, I think, the right direction. You mentioned you do AI stuff. Obviously, I feel like we talk about that on every single one of our podcasts, but can you go a little bit into how you guys use that? I mean, and how you, and the ethics behind it, and sort of the, I wouldn't say necessarily every algorithm you use, but sort of the tech and how you, you know, implement that.
Yeah. And so, you know, again, we're source centric. And then of course, from that, and by that core architecture, we're able to give you a lot of analytics on narrative intelligence. And it's not just the who, of course, it's the what. And so we use, we have our own lots of large language models, and we've been in this space for deep in the last 4.5 years. Where I think a lot of the criticism of AI comes in, which is correct, is, you know, people think that AI is some, you know, human soul. It's not. It's a math trick. It's a very good math trick, but it's math. And I think, you know, when you go ask OpenAI or GPT, whatever, today to go write an English paper, you know, it gives you a pretty darn good paper, but it lies to you. It can fake who the sources are. And it's completely not transparent and completely not auditable. Like, you just either like it or you don't like it. There's no way to go back and audit it. So we're so different in this sense that, and I think the future, we give AI or prompting context, tremendous context. So when you go ask OpenAI to go write a paper about the Russians, it's going to, it has bias, it has all types of stuff. We say, here are 5 articles from XYZ. Now give me a summary. I'm simplifying, right? So it's tremendous signal over noise when you start with context. The other thing that we do, which is very, very unique, and one of our really unique things, besides our approach to the world and our worldview of entities pursuing goals, we're very unique in how we do what we call narrative tracing and how we trace narratives thematically, domain, like with you, what you do. And then lastly, geospatially. So again, the government said, we got to have maps. And so we now show how we call them intercontinental ballistic narratives, ICBNs. And we show literally how an ICBN is shot out of Moscow and lands in Jackson, Mississippi, right? Or Wyoming, because it's some adversary pumping out something to go divide us at the election poll, right? It happens every day, this cognitive war. And so we show it very graphically, just like intercontinental ballistic missiles. But what we do, how we're able to do that is, we're deep into lots of, we hire lots of mathematicians, discrete math, because we basically put ones and zeros to every language in the world. And so when a source, we consume their publicly available Reddit, Twitter, X, whatever, Telegram, VK in Russia, Sinoweibo, QQ, whatever it might be, we bring that in, we vectorize and clusterize using lots of different kind of models, and we're able to show not how people, which is what most of the, a lot of the governments use is like keyword matching. And while that's interesting, right, we go way beyond that into how people are talking about the same idea, not using the same words. And we can show from a similarity scale from 75 to 99% how people are talking similarly using different languages, different thoughts. Does that make sense? So that's how we really, we're special with our AIs.
That absolutely makes sense. It absolutely makes sense. I can see as the world evolves and they understand that concept, things getting harder. One of my favorite things ever was a while back when I think it was 4chan, and maybe in a Telegram group, where they came up with using, instead of using the N-word, they started using Google as the word for that. And Google's algorithms kept pumping all these articles and blogs and stuff up to the top because their name was in it. I'd love to understand how the math would like figure that out. And one of the things we've noticed in our own research is what you just said. It sounds like you guys are trying to solve, and that's the words and the phraseologies change. I mean, a really simple, a really simple idea in that is like a social distancing. All right. We all know what that is now, but if we went back to 2019 and we said, hey, you need a social distance, people are like, what are you talking about? You know?
Yeah.
And so, I think that's incredibly powerful if you guys can do that effectively. And from a language model, Dan has this fun quote I love when people say, "Hey, I love AI," and he's like, "Oh, linear algebra, cool." You know, like, and most people,
yeah, I'm always like, "How long have you enjoyed linear algebra?" And they're always like, "Oh, I don't know what this guy's talking about." I'm like,
yeah.
I don't know how AI you are, right?
Yeah. So we definitely have done a lot of work in that space as well. Cool. So if you guys could effectively pull that off, I'd be very impressed, because I think that's the hardest part of this, is the way people speak online changes constantly. And I've used 4chan as an example, but you got Telegram and you've got all these things that just,
I think it's cool, especially if you were monitoring some of the forums and channels around people getting around the Chinese firewall, right? Like, those guys are changing their slang to get around the firewall daily or almost every 4 to 6 hours. It would be great to turn some of your stuff on those forums itself and then be like, hey, let's push some information into China to enable people to get around that firewall even better, faster, at mass. So it just kind of creates this wave of freedom and people to get get around the Chinese firewall. You know, that would be awesome. Like, just flip what you're doing right now. Let's use it to, mess with China. You know, that'd be awesome.
Yeah. My thing, I mean, yeah, of course. Yeah. I mean, how do we, play offense, right? Play offense. We've gotten pretty good in, any asset-based forum, we're pretty good at, right? So it's not, a lot of it, well, in the adversarial world, they use all types of stuff, but it depends. If we're trying to look at how formal line influence is affecting Americans, it's going to be in English, right? But when right. Markets are a big, digital currencies are a huge area where you have lots of that from a discourse and stuff like that. But yeah, no,
So Joe, like with all the data that you guys have and everything that you've seen so far, what foreign country is the best at spinning narratives? And I know like most people are going to say Russia. Feel free to not say Russia if they're not the best.
Yeah.
I mean, which one is the best from what you've seen so far?
Well, I mean, that's from an adversarial standpoint, you got the big three, right? Primarily Russia, China, Iran. And they're clearly every day hurling ICBMs, all over to not just, for elections and just disruption. I think, and of course the Russians, we were talking about this at the conference, right? They wrote the book in 1923, right? And they it's public, right? Their worldview and their approach, it's just the mediums change dramatically, right? So they've been in this business for a long time. I think the CCP and others, I worry about that quite a bit, because it's not so much that they're really a little more, I think, intelligent in how they do it. They can't spell very well in English, but I think some of the techniques they're using is pretty powerful. And the Iranians, are pretty significant too. But what's more complicated than if you think about, those are the three classic, I would say formalign influence. But what's really crazy and what's really messy is the world's not really geographical. And so, we are very good at finding the influence. And we might have a source tag Russia because they're in Moscow, right? They're state media or something, or what we call advanced persistent manipulators, APMs. But that very well, that asset might be in London. That asset might be in South America, Russians.
You're describing something I have tried a million times to explain to a million people, that where they're at in the world is really hard to figure out.
It's very hard. And so, back to sort of think what Daniel, we talked about briefly, but I think, again, the more you build a better dossier or a baseball card on that source, we show where the origin of that ICBN was. But anyway, but I think what's complicated is the cognitive war that we're all in, whether it's United States, but every single, I preach this all the time. I think narrative intelligence is agnostic, and I don't think there's a difference between national security and a big global company. Our adversaries want to disrupt, commerce, treasury, health, and so it's not so much just about, it's not kinetic. In the kinetic side of things, it's like kinetic warfare.
Right.
In the cognitive side of things, there is no difference. And so
there's a destruction of like every trust center in society. That could be. Whatever you outsource your trust to, it could be the CDC, it could be your grocery store, because it's got a supply chain nationally, like things that are bigger and there's, some reliance on it. If anything is disrupted in the trust of that entity, even elections, that's where the divide is. And that's where you start having some of that fallout.
Anything. Yeah. Look at the vaccine narrative. That was, and again, the challenge is we as a democracy, clearly they want to hurl anything to disrupt democracy, right? And the greatest, experiment ever of all mankind, right? And they just don't stick to one thing. So it's very hard. And as Eli was mentioning, they're everywhere. And so it's not just all in a certain geography. They're everywhere. Sometimes they don't even know who they are. I mean, we paint a better picture of the adversarial networks than they know themselves, because we can show how people talk similarly. And they don't even know they're on the same team. This journalist.
the geography, I think, is going to melt away. And Joe, you talk about, you know, the trigger, the chatter, and then, the, you know, building the narrative or putting it together. But, you know, the thing that, you know, former PSYOP dude is that narrative at some point becomes a belief, right?
Yeah.
Then you have to figure out the intent, right? Because you can say it can be a Russian actor that's coming out of London, but you still have to figure out what the intent of that particular actor is, right? So then the belief is there.
It's a great point. You know, yeah. I think, it's all about, our whole pitch is we give you decision advantage because mm-hmm. that's very important, right? Accelerating, optimizing decision making as a leader, as a general, as a chief risk officer at a big Fortune 50 company. End of the day, how do I make a faster, quicker, optimal decision in an overwhelming information environment that is compounding every second of the day with generative AI? It's just, Google's going to get worse and worse. They're getting worse and worse at guessing what you want to see, right? It's just too much of an environment. The information environment is massive. Man.
So that thing they did with their AI this week. Did you see that?
Gemini. Yeah. I mean, but I think one thing you're pointing out that I think has to be talked about, sometimes people don't want to talk about it, is not only is the information environment growing at some rapid amount that no human can consume, make sense of, or react to. I mean, that's the pain that we sell to, right? We want to give you decision advantage in the palm of your hand to that in the military, y'all call it the bluff, right? What's the bottom line up front? I can't read 18,000 articles, mm-hmm. right? I'm right now on the ground. What is the ground truth before I land my plane, before I kick in a door, whatever? But here's where it gets complicated. Our adversaries, if you look at culture, and I love studying, I've studied every religion and culture. I love that kind of stuff. You look at the West, and the West has very much moved from a postmodern to a post-truth world. And when you look at those, how those things occur.
I would say postmodernism is kind of a post-truth world. I mean, roots of post-truth is everything is relative and there's no absolute truth. Right. So
that's a great point. And so and that is what we have today. And so to your point, if that means anything is true, our adversaries eat that up. For every horrible thing they are, they're black and white.
Yeah, but it's a classic attack pattern, right? Like this has been talked about for centuries where, you know, it's all about input validation, right? So how can I influence an outcome? Or how can I exploit a computer, right? Like input validation. There's no input validation. There's no evaluation of what's in front of me, the story, the, you know, invitation to rage on social media, or the thing that's spurring you on your drive home as you listen to talk radio. It's getting you pissed off, right? Like all of these things are edging you towards having a desire and then an action, you know? So it's, you know, There's the planting of it. Then there's it culminates for a while. It moves slowly into, oh, I really want to do this. You know, like some guy that, like, let's say a great example of it is a guy who's married, happy marriage, has an idea of, oh man, maybe there's more adventure somewhere else, right? It that desire moves into an action, and then, you know, the action is the destruction of their marriage, right? So narratives, computer exploitation, all of this, it's the same attack pattern, right? Of, hey, bypass input validation and get to influencing somebody to an action. And that's why I think this is so interesting, because it's not just a threat of foreign actors. It's also like this, like, okay, now how do we re-engineer our educational system at the ground roots for critical thinking? I mean, we used to have that, at least in the United States. We haven't had it for 20, 30, 40 years, right? But I think that's a really important component to, you know, fighting this, not necessarily knowing who's behind it. And it doesn't really matter what the content is if you can practice critical thinking on the front end. And I think that's one of the great things about what you guys are doing at Edge Theory is you're able to automate some of that critical thinking for a decision maker. And I think it's not just cool for national security. I think, man, let's go short some stocks or something, right? Like, that there's a lot of ways to use that as a cool weapon. I'm rambling on right now, but
I think that's right. And I think the point is, since we do live in that kind of culture, whether and we can argue how we got there, it's really irrelevant, right? It is where we are. And so our adversaries see that. And what I've learned a lot talking to the government, you know, that first mover advantage is everything. I mean, it's always been that way. And so when you can hurl an ICBM, right, into America or the West, someone's going to believe it because anything is true. And once you've done that, no matter how hard you try to debunk it, it's proven on left and right studies, it's too late. And so it's all about the offensive. It's all about being, and of course, I don't know how to do this necessarily, but we in America, the West, have the best story.
Well,
We got to tell our story.
I totally agree. We do have the best story, you know, free market capitalism. We actually have a constitution that we follow, right? Like, and it's also dedicated to God. That's one thing that a lot of other constitution based republics don't always do. And I think that might be actually one of the big differences, you know, like,
it's the concept of where power comes from. That's an interesting, or where rights come from. If it comes from a document or from a government, it's editable conceptually, but that's a very interesting aspect of it.
Yeah, I'm getting riled.
But I think, you know, the offensive side, you know, we it depends on who the customer is. But one of the things that I think that we see is missing, and we see unique to us over anybody else, is of course we our narrative tracing is pretty awesome, I think. But then we're able to basically build the arsenal, what we call aligned messaging, and that's something that, you know, when you're a commercial enterprise, you need to go build your narrative, right? That's what we're really, and we've done that for lots of big folks in the commercial space. So, you know, it's not enough just to understand the narrative. You know, you got to be driving a narrative, right?
Right. I also have another question. So you talked about foreign stuff. What about the influence of some of these foreign ideas coming into mainstream media within the United States? Or within a country that then the amplifier is actually the domestic media? Is it based on foreign ideas coming in that are influencing that amplification within, like, let's say the United States, or is it an idealistic bend within the United States making it kind of something domestic, right? Like, so what does the data tell you from what you've seen?
Well, I mean, it's both. I mean, you know, again, let's talk about the adversaries. They love to use, of course, again, think of it as a missile or think of it as a system. They use our systems, our distribution, right? Besides TikTok, right? They use our stuff, right? Our shotguns, our rifles. Yeah. They use our shotguns, our rifles. They use our bullets most of the time, right? I mean, it depends on who you're talking about, but they do create, they have, you know, clearly disinformation as a service, massive disinformation services groups over there that are constantly pumping out content. But I think the most damaging of the bullets they use is our own media, for sure. So you know, and they know that. Again, they play on that, and so they know they can take a right or a left position with our own media. And they can amplify that with their persona, right? Makes sense, you know, all the time. Again, with language detection and narrative tracing, remember, we're able to show how they literally took, you know, an article from this US publication, tweaked two or three words and called it their article. I mean, that is so evident. We show that every day. So I think it's both. And then of course, so they're taking our media, amplifying our media. But then remember, their whole point, I don't know if you ever read like Screwtape Letters, one of my cool books by C.S. Lewis, incredible book. That's what they do, right? They get you to think and they get in your head, and they want you, you know, drive your emotions. And then the next thing you know, you're shooting the same missile they just shot.
Right, right.
Yeah. Remember, and that's where it gets very complex.
You know, back to the active measures, 1923, you know, Soviet doctrine is propaganda has to have a kernel of truth. And so if it doesn't have that truth, it's just a lie. It just, lies don't work, right? So it's got to be a narrative has to piggyback on some small amount of truth.
Yeah, yeah. So, there's never disinformation is never all. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. That's very critical. But yeah, but I think it's, and that's where it gets complicated when you start looking at things, you know, on a global scale like we do. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, seen some of our stuff, and it's like a command center, but yeah. it's very complex. And what we don't show a lot of times is if you start combining those sources from different places, you see a very, you know, what we typically show is just these sources, right? Here's the map. But if you put that, which we can, across all sources, and put that on like a heat map, it's pretty, the cognitive war, you know, again, we want to stress that it is happening every single day. And it is much easier, as you and I talked about, I believe, much easier to hack the mind than hack a machine. Now, I mean, you're obviously very good at that, but I'm saying it's a lot easier to hack, you know, Grandma Betty's mind than to hack a machine.
Oh yeah, totally.
I don't mean, but I always use poor Grandma Betty. I don't know who she is, but you know. I, yeah.
No, we know who she is. We're very aware of who she is.
Yeah.
I want to shift gears a little bit to a concept that's crossed my mind in this conversation. So we published a blog a couple days ago, and it was about child exploitation online, everybody's favorite subject, right? But you know, we were talking about a few different platforms, but one of the things we talked about was Roblox. And a few years ago, you could get on Roblox and go to a group. Again, Roblox is a platform designed for children, you know, like kids. It's got like 100 million users or something, right? And you could go on there and you could find really explicit stuff in the group chats. And at some point when they went public, they decided maybe we shouldn't have that in there. And so I'm assuming what they did is they designed it so it looked for words like, you know, cock or, you know, sex or something, and went, take that out of there. So if you go look at their stuff today, I could pull up a screen, and in about 30 seconds, we could find someone trying to exploit children. I mean, literally, it's that easy. It's very easy. But if I were to go in today and look at what they're writing, they're not writing stuff like that. They're writing sort of vague things and in ways that are getting around the filters and getting around the easy way to spot it. So I can imagine this technology being really useful for, you know, I would say one of the biggest growing problems in the world, and that's, you know, child exploitation and trafficking, and the online space is the marketplace for, you know, 90% of that. So I can see that being a very...
I think we should take some of the data sets that we've got offline. Let's go over to Ole Miss, hang out with Joe. Let's make a new, you know... Let's make some new module with our data in their stuff to help detect that at scale. I think we should totally do that. I mean, we already have the data. Let's put it on a hard drive, drive it to Ole Miss. And I mean, I don't, you know, like, it's not even about money at that point. It's like, hey, let's plug this into some of these platforms for them, into y'all stuff, into our stuff. And it's, you know, some kind of, you know, almost near wire speed detection on a language model. That's just like, dude, this is a groomer. Just report it to NetMake or something, you know?
And that is a great idea. Both y'all, Elliot, and just two things there. We're very passionate about human rights and child exploitation. And I mean, just, you know, who shouldn't be? I mean, we actually have, you know, with our interns that come from across the country, we actually have a school. I won't say who it is, but they're amazingly into this topic. Incredible. Mm-hmm. I have some of the best interns in our program. They're not in Oxford, another school that we work with. I mean, everything comes out of Oxford. I mean, works in Oxford. But we have kids that are so passionate about this topic, Elliot, that use, and with y'all's data would be even more powerful. But remember, when we do narrative tracing, you can start, Elliot, with what y'all found to be that vague sentence, right? We can put that in our system across a group of modules and sources, and we can then show how people are saying that same thing to go identify more sources like
exactly.
That.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, like this
fingerprints that effectively. And then, I mean, I think there's also something that we could do with all the years of 4chan and 8chan data that we've got. Like, I've always thought that would be a great Turing integrity test for a language model, because there's so many out of bounds, you know, language idioms used.
It evolves constantly.
Yeah, it's always evolving. And I think that would be really cool just to see what can we all learn together, like mixing OSINT with, you know, the National Center for Narrative Intelligence.
Well, and one thing, guys, that also is tied into that, which really opened my eyes, working with some police chiefs and just really opened my eyes, and the local level, like these fusion centers, is when certain events happen, let's just say sports, it is amazing the traffic that picks up in these places.
It's crazy. We've seen this. Crazy. Yes.
And so, again, there's another whole nother way to apply this. I mean, you know, it's predictable. It's predictable.
I think there is an uptick on some of the traffic of sex workers at sporting events. I'm still on the line of if there's an uptick on human trafficking exploitation. Because I just think those are, there is a fine line with that. You know, like we helped out a few years ago with the Super Bowl. Forget which one it was, but you know, I saw like nine out of 10 ads were workers, not pure victims, you know?
Yeah.
So I think it would be nice to see what your data shows on that and what our experience has been in that. Cause it is definitely an uptick, but I don't know if it's an uptick in human trafficking yet. You know?
Yeah. But great point. Yeah, that's a great use case of narrative tracing for sure.
Yeah, because I mean, we could be, you know, nonprofits that are trying to do anti-human trafficking work could be boosting this as a narrative to get donor dollars, which is kind of almost worse, right?
There's someone, David, from your community that our mutual friend has introduced me to, and I can't remember his online, but it's a guy from the soft community that just is all about like hunting down. I can't remember.
So we work with, we work with tons of NGOs that in the human trafficking world, especially from the soft community or special operations community, because, you know, folks shed the uniform and they're looking for purpose and identity. What better to do than track child predators? So we run the gamut on human trafficking and orgs that counter a lot of that. And then so I know we're running out of time here, but I wanted to get to the center. Tell us, Joe, how you came to.
So the center, you know, it's the National Center for Narrative Intelligence. You know, I've learned a lot about academia, but it's a long way it got here, but it's now official. And you know, again, back to, you know, narrative intelligence being a critical new sport, I think we all agree in the OSINT community, you know, we as Edge Theory want to be the best team at that sport. But you know, the way I look at Ole Miss is a unique place. I want that to be the Kansas of basketball for narrative intelligence, right? How do we look at that as that kind of place? It's a logical place with you know, from the Faulkners, I mean, no one can dispute the literary back, you know, the just incredible thought that comes out of their storytelling. And it's storytelling that drives the world, true or false. It doesn't matter. True. So that's the reason for, you know, why they're over California, Stanford or whatever, you know.
Or Washington, D.C.
And so also, you know, our customers really like the idea of it being out of the beltway, for sure.
Joe, I loved it. I loved going there. I'm going back again.
You know, Dave's gonna have to hold me back from buying a condo or something down there because I think it was awesome. I'm like, dude, this is
great. I'm going in with you.
All right, we're gonna buy a condo. We're gonna get a coffee shop. We're gonna go to the National Center for National Intelligence, Narrative Intelligence, and add all the OSINT in there.
Students. I think it's a great place, and I think, you know, it's you know, again, its focus though, real quickly, is research and workforce development. Right? Yeah. And how do we, you know, what we're really working on now with the co-directors is how do we look at, you know, really coming up with a certification of narrative intelligence, right? And how do we give that to rotations, you know, whether they come in from the DOD, the IC, or the private sector? How do people come in and get certified, you know, or in a training in this completely new thing that everybody says is important? But that's really the goal, is research, workforce development.
We should do both. Let's do that, and then we'll add OSINT and give our tools to some of the new, you know, students in the investigative side.
Great. Be great.
And I mean, and then you can talk to Elliot about how you're running your internship program sometime. And
yeah,
we've got an internship program as well. And then we also have David. It's the veterans coming out.
DoD Skill Bridge program.
Yeah. So we've got that as well. So, you know, like kind of as two different companies in the data space, you know, I think it's important to highlight that we are trying to work at the beginning and at folks middle of their career to help them assimilate into something new, you know?
And, you know, and one thing to that point, Daniel, that was really exciting, Dr. Boyce, the chancellor at Ole Miss, who really, you know, took this original vision I gave him and was just been incredible supportive behind it, as well as Washington and everybody else. He said something really profound one time. And he said, you know, to me and some administration, he's like, this is going to really take off with young people. It's going to be bigger, interdisciplinary than anything we've ever seen. And he goes, you know why? We all sit around the table and we grew up in a world before the internet, right? So we know how to filter the information environment. These kids have been flooded. And I think we need to show more empathy to the younger generation. We're like, oh, they're throw away the phone. I mean, they can't throw away the phone. But I think we need to have more literacy, if you will. And they are so overwhelmed with the information environment. And when you show them narrative intelligence and tools that allow them to see that, put structure to this crazy cognitive war that they've been stuck in, they're like, wow.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's a lot of things there. I mean, we could talk all day about this, but the demographics of kids that are growing up now, you know, Ole Miss age, right? 22 or so, born right before or right after 9/11. They've seen something in the national security space that's very unique, and that it's borderless now. It's been borderless for a long time. And now we're headed back into this, you know, Cold War type, whatever, great power competition. You know, a lot of folks talked about it last week at the summit, but there are no borders to this world. And I go back to the beliefs, right? It's hard to change a belief, and to track these ideas, track these narratives, and then drill down in the open source world or open source intelligence, it's going to be essential, I think.
I would also add in there, like, as much as there is a huge signal and noise level with narratives affecting people and their worldview and how they perceive reality as a threat, there's an equal desire for people that want to know what the truth is, right? And so kind of going back to like arming those kids and arming the younger part of the population as they're learning how to analyze things, have critical thinking, all that stuff, you know, you'll know the truth and the truth will set you free, right? Like that's the concept. And that's also where that American exceptionalism has always been, is there is real truth, you know, like America really did totally kick Russia's butt on all sides of the coin with just some basic free market principles. You know, we really do have grocery stores, people in Russia, and it's full of food. And I know you guys are starving because you eat all the slice. You know what I mean? Like, anyway.
The one thing that I loved hearing last week at the summit was Jim Barksdale and, you know, all the government folks and talking about this or that. And it was interesting. There wasn't a single strategist up there that said, this is how we win the narrative war.
Oh, yeah.
But Jim Barksdale, you know, he said, never underestimate the power of the free market economy and American capital.
Oh, yeah.
And that, you know, you,
that was it.
He could have done the mic drop right there and been done with it. But.
Yeah. Right. And then bring in, you know, the Basic Economics book by Thomas Sowell, right? Where he just basically just destroys the difference between policy and economics.
I need to bring a sound effect for every time Dan brings up Sowell.
Dude, he's awesome because he's got tons of data. He can attack some of these larger narratives and policy issues with historical data from all around the world. And he has for 30 plus years. I mean, the guy, and it's amazing some of the data that he's got. A lot of people just want to ignore him, I think, in some forms of media within the United States. But look at the data, and it's really awesome. You know, the data tells a story.
Yeah.
Well, you know, one thing, I think it's funny because I just, you know, as an entrepreneur, I've been beating this like a dead horse. I mean, I've been seeing the narrative as your greatest asset, your greatest liability since, you know, as early as I can remember. And people looked at me like I was crazy. And now, you know, mm-hmm. you can't go anywhere. And ESPN uses the word narrative. The preacher uses the word narrative. I mean, everybody right. uses the word narrative. And I think it's something we just got to take seriously that, you know, we can, and again, we need to have ships and things like that. But we got to wake up. And again, it's the whole of society. This is not a military problem. This is the whole of society problem.
Yeah, I agree.
It's a big part of the narrative center, the national center. We got to look at this, and it's going to be a completely different model that we've never been trained for, but we have to all go fight and tell our story, right? It's not the military. They can't do that. Yeah. Title 10, you know, but we have to find a way, and we have to go take this incredible, true, wonderful story. Jim Barstow mentioned it, and we got to go push it, all of us, you know, and that's the only way we're going to win. And I think it will, we will win. But we just got to have, and I think this National Center is going to be a huge part of that narrative, right? That truthful, wonderful narrative, you know?
Yeah. And I'll also put a plug in there for classical education. Hey, you know, if you're a parent here thinking about, you know, I don't want to send my kids to this school or that school, and I want them to have the best thing. Like, classical education solves a lot of this. We're going back in time with, you know, a little bit more rigor. But there's a great methodology in classical education. You know, check out, you know, some resources like thewelltrainedmind.com. There's all sorts of stuff, at least within the United States that I know about, that it's a movement. There's a lot of people sending their kids there, and I've seen some of the outcomes of it with my kids. I mean, it's crazy. Like, you know, it's awesome. Some of the stuff that they're pushing at an early age, and kids don't even know, like, oh, this is the hard level, just because it's normalized. And that pushes the critical thinking a great deal. So, Joe, I'll send you something my daughter wrote just last week. She had held a position on, you know, why funding the Ukraine war was a good thing. She had to take that stance in her debate class, but you know, they're pushing these debates earlier and earlier in schools like this. And it's something to check out, you know, really fun stuff.
Yeah. I think also one thing my 22-year-old son said, it was very profound to me the other day. Again, back to this, having more empathy, right? I mean, again, I'm all about discipline, but having more empathy, because we with this information environment that's just been bombarding, but yeah, he was saying, like, you know, we have such a, the younger generation has this really paradox. They have this crazy amount of information. Think about it. I grew up riding my bicycle and, you know, I sound like the old man, right? But I, you know, my influence were my friends and the playground, whatever. And now they have this thing in their hand that gives mm-hmm. them crazy information. So they do have many times a better perspective than us, right? But the problem is sometimes half of it's wrong and not true. Yeah. But that's people use the word media literacy or information literacy. I do think I'm a big proponent that there needs to be some kind of information, just not at all what we're talking about, like changing anybody's completely free speech, but there needs to be something out there that helps people understand not what's what, and not no one can opine, but I don't know, it's just something that we're gonna have to look at that, I think, at the level. And the classical thinking, of course, is I'm a big fan of that as well. So
history. Yeah. All right, we got to wrap here. Lightning round. We got to keep Nico's tradition alive. What's everyone reading?
Oh, yeah. All right. Somebody else go. I'll pull up the book that I'm reading.
I'm reading The Hero of Two Worlds by Mike Duncan. It's about Lafayette.
Nice.
I'm a mega fan of Duncan. If you guys are bored and need 100,000 hours of podcast, go check out his History of Rome or Revolutions podcast. They're really good. But I didn't realize he had written that book until recently. And I didn't know that much about Lafayette, but what amazing character.
So. Oof. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm reading Propaganda, The Formation of Men's Attitudes by Jacques Ellul. It's got some great stuff in there. One of the small little snippets that he talks about is, who's, you know, intellectuals being the most vulnerable to propaganda versus the other side of the coin. And I think a lot of times, especially, you know, when I was at the conference, it sounded like a lot of people were saying, oh, a bunch of idiots are vulnerable to narrative based, you know, disinformation versus intellectuals being vulnerable to it a little bit more. And he kind of talked about three different areas where intellectuals are more susceptible to propaganda. One is they absorb large amounts of information more than most people. The other thing is they feel compelled to have an opinion about every single thing in the universe. They can't just say, I don't really know, I'll check it out, right? It's always, I got to take a hard stance because I got to be seen as supremely super smart, right? And then they feel like they have to be able to judge every piece of information as truth or, you know, half truth themselves. So, you know, that's one of the things that I really thought it was interesting. It's written in like what, 1962, David?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So this is kind of pre the internet, right? But right when color TV is starting to probably, you know, or it's probably black and white TV then, but TV is starting to come into people's living rooms. And it's pretty interesting. I like it. It's, you know, it's cool.
Yeah. I have a problem. I have like a lot of little things on my bedside table, but I had not read, we had, you know, Peter Singer there last week, which is very interesting. And I've enjoyed Like War, but I picked back up because I never really finished it. Ghost Fleet. Right.
Yeah.
And what does that look like? And in my mind of being consumed by narratives every day and knowing what people are doing, it's, I even have some more radical thoughts than that World War III. I really, it just makes me think that we, you know, the narrative war is, the cognitive war is the greatest future conflict.
It's really funny that you brought that up. So a couple nights ago, I was with a whole bunch of journalists and, you know, they figured out my background and they said, what do you think about China? Are we going, you know, we headed to World War III? And I said, you know, who knows, right? And, you know, listed off a whole list of things, but they go, but China has the carrier killers. And I thought to myself, and it was that, that's not the thing that's going to defeat us. That has nothing to do with what's really going to happen. I mean,
you look at the analogy, my same friend who gave me the analogy of intercontinental ballistic narratives, mm-hmm. ICBMs, sort of going down this whole path of now just take the nuclear, right? We all have nuclear, so we're not going to nuke each other. But because we both have what? We both have an arsenal.
Yeah.
But in this cognitive world, we got zero arsenal.
And yeah, yes, we do. I got a ton of ideas on this. Let's meet up and, you know, let's launch our own, you know.
Let's go to Montana. Let's go to Montana.
Yeah, let's go to Montana or Texas.
It's a nice place.
Yeah, maybe we go to Texas, rent a ranch and shoot some, you know, do some hunting, and that'd be awesome.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed it.
Awesome. Yeah. It was great seeing you again, Joe. I'll send you a signal message.
Okay. Nice to meet you, Elliot.
Good to meet you, too.
Thanks, David.
Yep, anytime.
Thanks, guys.